From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Fed spooks the markets, a farm bill goes nowhere, protests rock Brazil, and we say goodbye to the man who played Tony Soprano. Stocks slumped sharply after Chairman Ben Bernanke said the Fed is looking to ease off its market stimulus as conditions improve.
Overall, the committee believes the downside risks to the outlook for the economy and the labor market have diminished since the fall. But we will continue to evaluate economic conditions and risks as they evolve.
Huge crowds hit the streets in Brazil as bus fare hikes sparked waves of protest over much more.
In Rio, crowds of 300,000 marched towards the city hall. Many different people angry at many different things.
And actor James Gandolfini is gone at just 51. The world knew him as Tony Soprano, the tough but vulnerable New Jersey mob boss who spilled his heart to his therapist.
They made me take off my shoes, and I nearly passed out in front of everybody trying to bend over.
Well, that's not good.
People misinterpret. They think you're weak. They see an opportunity. They're my friends, a lot of them, but they're also jackals.
They're also jackals. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What's your top story this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington this week, Brian Monroe, editor of CNNPolitics.com. Brian, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, it's always great to be with you.
It's great to have you today. And from Philadelphia, Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, great to have you back as well.
Great to be back, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Brian, and Trudy.
We've got a lot to look at all over the place this week, but I want to just start with that farm bill. Great, great big money here. And we saw the Republican Oklahoma Congressman Frank Lucas, chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, practically on his knees saying, please pass this bill. They didn't do it, but boy, did he beg.
Whether you believe the bill has too much reform or not enough, or you believe it cuts too much or it doesn't cut enough, we have to move this document forward to achieve a common goal, to meet the needs of our citizens.
Didn't happen. Nancy Pelosi was very ready to say amateur hour.
What is happening on the floor today was a demonstration of major amateur hour. They didn't get results, and they put the blame on somebody else.
Brian, we've got all kinds of subsidies in here and all kinds of food stamps and food for the poor, and yet gone nowhere. What's going on?
I think partly because of that, you have seen, and this is a great example of it, the power or the strength of the conservative caucus in the Republican Party being able to, you know, basically dictate terms. They thought they had a deal. They thought they had this thing greased and ready to go, and clearly it wasn't. It was the food stamps. The conservatives thought they'd spent too much on the food stamps and nutrition programs. The Democrats thought it didn't spend enough, and they really did not like the new work requirements. And so, you know, all these last-minute things added up to really sinking this, and it showed how crippled Congress is. CNN did our latest poll, continued to show among approval ratings, you've got the president, you know, who's dropped a few points, 8 points. You've got the Supreme Court actually holding steady at about 48%. But Congress can't get above the 17% mark. People cannot stand what Congress is doing right now.
Jack Beatty, maybe this is a sign of sincerity among Republicans. They've talked a lot about deficits. Now here's this great big deficit. And even when it comes to the agricultural states where they have very strong voter support, they're not willing to go forward here. Too much money, they say.
Too much money. And they're all afraid, or at least a substantial number, of being primaried if they vote for anything to which Democrats agree. I mean, that's a sort of background music to all this. You know, this was a tremendous defeat for the speaker. He's had one after another of these humiliations from his own caucus. When he came to the floor, he said he was going to vote for this himself. Speakers rarely vote. He made a sort of, in his fashion, a plea for it. And he was rejected by his own people. This augurs very ominously for the immigration bill, which is even harder, of course, on the politics. And if the speaker can't get through a bill with these sorts of goodies in it for his own people, It's hard to see on that how that immigration bill is going to get through as it exists now.
But Brian, in effect, the old bill just rolls over the farm bill here. So I mean, everything kind of goes steady as she goes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and going back to Boehner, this is such a big defeat for him, you know, that he cannot even lead his own caucus to get to what he wants. You know, Jack is absolutely right. When we come to immigration, which is going to be a doozy, this thing might be dead on arrival here.
We will look at immigration. Trudy, help us understand Brazil for a second. We're hearing the news at the top of the hour. You know, they want more effective government out in the streets in huge numbers in dozens of cities. Americans are not doing that about Congress not passing the farm bill. But what has got Brazilians so hot under the collar here? We thought this was the great success story.
I know. It's fascinating. And in many ways, it's linked to Turkey. It's linked to Russia. This is the realization in Brazil of a population that is seeing large numbers rise in income, that they want more. You know, it's the revolution of rising expectations. It's the increased number of middle-class Brazilians. They have access to the internet. They see corruption rising. They feel that they're not being listened to. And they see that services are inadequate, schools are inadequate. For the first time, you have people in favelas who are, in a way, coming into the system, more aware of it, and they want what other people have. And they're dissatisfied with their government. They look at institutions that don't work. In a sense, what's happening in Turkey is the same thing, although there are the complications of religion there. But you have middle-class young people in the cities who want their government to work better, who feel they're not being listened to, with the added factor there, of course, that they feel that the Islamist government is pressing down on the seculars. But this is a sort of wannabe middle-class, lower-middle-class revolt against governments they no longer believe in. And you can see it caught the Brazilian government just totally off base because it thinks of itself as the hero of the working class.
Jack Beatty makes Occupy Wall Street look like peanuts, what we just overnight practically see in the streets of Brazil.
Yes, in the Times today, someone compares it to the way music takes off around the world. You never know what is going to work next.
Gangnam style, except it's a tear gas style.
That's right. That's right. I was struck by the comment of a young man, 26 years old, a tech support assistant in Rio. He said, they don't invest in education, they don't invest in infrastructure, and they keep putting makeup on the city to show the world that we can host the World Cup and the Olympics.
Makeup on the city. Watch Brazil. Yeah, Brian, sorry.
And that's interesting. This thing started, oddly enough, as a 9-cent increase on the bus fare.
Yeah.
And that set everybody off. And now it's about, you know, people saying, hey, we need, you know, health and education and roads and bridges. We don't need 10 more stadiums for the World Cup. Forget the World Cup. You know, give us a hospital.
And up in arms. Never mind 9 cents on the bus fare. We've got big movements in the stock market this week. And it began, though there's a China piece to this, and we'll look at that. But it began with the Federal Reserve Bank Chairman Ben Bernanke saying the punch bowl is going to have to come away at some point as the economy gets going. He insisted it wouldn't happen too quick. The sell-off happened anyway. Here's Bernanke on Wednesday.
If the incoming data support the view that the economy is able to sustain a reasonable cruising speed, we will ease the pressure on the accelerator by gradually reducing the pace of purchases. However, any need to consider applying the brakes by raising short-term rates is still far in the future.
Okay, it's Fed speak, Brian, but it got stock market people. I mean, maybe that's just gone up so much, people are ready to say, I'm going to take my gains off the table and go. I don't know. It seems to have stabilized a little bit today, but who knows where this goes now?
Yeah, you know, the sell-off that happened with 330-some points,
yep.
The largest of the year. You know, it's got the markets are worried about are the – here's an interesting thing, that what they're reacting to is actually a good economy. And because the economy is going so well, that there's concern that the Fed will dial back or actually start to increase the rates. And a hot economy, you dial up the rates to cool it down a little bit so it doesn't get out of control. You don't have all the bubbles that we experienced before. So in some way, it's the goodness of the economy that people are freaking out about.
And the Fed says it won't be juicing it forever. We've got to get used to that. Trudy, interestingly, in China, they've got some slowdown there in manufacturing. And the government there trying to put pressure on the Chinese banks to get their act together, become more efficient. That gives this thing a global cast right now.
Right. Well, the Chinese problem is not necessarily linked to this global problem, although obviously there's interconnectedness. But the Chinese banks have always been a problem because there are links between the banks and Communist Party officials in cities who are overbuilding construction. There are links between the banks and state-owned industries that are very inefficient and are getting loans that they'll never be able to pay back. So the government is always trying to deal with this problem. But Bernanke's remarks, not only may indirectly reverberate in China, but you see it reverberating in developing countries because hedge funds have been borrowing money on the cheap in the United States and then investing in foreign stock and bond funds where they think they can get better interest rates. And now suddenly, with the hint that interest rates are going to climb, they're pulling out massive amounts of money from bond funds of developing countries and bonds. And so it's shaking up the globe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Farm Bill in trouble, a Border Patrol surge, the Fed's Wall Street moves and Wall Street reeling, Brazil in the streets, and wrestling with the Taliban. We'll look at that as well. Trudy Rubin is with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Brian Monroe from CNNPolitics.com. Jack Beatty's here. Lots of talk about immigration bill, immigration reform, maybe a breakthrough, maybe not. On Tuesday, Speaker of the House John Boehner said he wouldn't even bring it to the floor, immigration reform, if it didn't have the support of a majority of Republicans in the House. Here's Boehner.
Any immigration reform bill that is going to go into law ought to have a majority of both parties support if we're really serious about making that happen. I don't see any way of bringing an immigration bill to the floor that doesn't have a majority support of Republicans.
The answer to that problem, maybe double up on border patrols, which have already been doubled up. Here is talking to Peter Alexander on MSNBC's Daily Rundown yesterday. This is Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee talking about the so-called border surge, bipartisan plan to pump up border security in hopes that that would help everything push through.
For people who are concerned about border security, once they see what is in this bill, it's almost overkill, Peter. I think if that's the issue that people have, I think everyone working together has come up with a way to deal with that issue. So I do hope that we can send it over to the House with some momentum.
Will that bring people on board? Maybe on Wednesday, Republican Senator Steve King of Iowa joined Tea Party activists rallying against immigration reform in the nation's capital, saying, hey, want to build a fence? Think about the Great Wall of China.
And some that argue, well, we can't build a 2,000-mile fence. It's too hard. It's too hard. Have you ever seen the Great Wall of China? That's 5,500 miles long.
Brian Monroe, I'm trying to picture a Great Wall of China in the New Mexico desert. Maybe it'll come to that. Where does immigration stand at this point, Brian? Is this huge double-up going to make it work?
You know, something you can see from the International Space
right,
Station or something.
Right,
who knows?
Right.
This is a really interesting piece that immigration right now is very close in the Senate. It was thought to be dead for a while. Now it's come back to life. And with this deal yesterday to double up, you know, another 20,000 border agents, 700 miles of fencing, $3.2 billion worth of technology along the border. They're piling everything in here. But here's what it could look like. Our Tom Cohen wrote about this morning. A border agent every 1,000 feet, every hour of every day, supported by 700 miles of fence along the border. At some point, and this is going to be very interesting to watch, the Democrats, and really actually the Republicans who also know that they need an immigration reform bill to pass to booster their support amongst Hispanics, and the Democrats who want this, and particularly President Obama as his, as one of his legacy laws, they're piling so much into this to try to get it over not just the 60 hurdle, but they're really shooting for the 70 vote hurdle in the Senate. That would put enough pressure on Boehner and the House Republicans that they have to take this up. Right now, Boehner is saying that he's going to invoke the Hastert rule, which is any law like this has to have not just the majority of the House, but the majority of the majority party, which means a majority of the Republicans. But they're loading this up with so much, someone's got to at some point say, whoa, time out. Let's look at this and say, are we going overkill just because we want to make some noise and actually look at the substance of the bill?
Earlier in a tweet, I think, the Gang of Eight was balking a $20 billion price tag. And now we're talking $30 billion?
At least. And, in the Gang of Eight, it's interesting. The Senate has shown how you can stay together on a bipartisan movement. They've been pretty tight through committee and now onto the floor and even beating back a lot of the amendments. But at some point, this is going to go like, whoa, hold on, time out.
Jack, what do you see happening here? I mean, how much can you pile on that border to buy support back home? What makes sense here? And does it squeak through with the many, many billions for security?
Well, it looks like it will squeak through in the Senate. At least. But the taxpayer must raise an eyebrow over this. I mean, this is made possible by the CBO's prediction that immigration reform would actually lower the deficit by nearly $200 billion over a decade, $700 billion over 20 years, be a great boon for the economy. So immediately the senators saw this money available, because it's all notional money, and they say, well, let's take a big pot of that and spend it on the border. Last year we spent something like $18 billion on that border, more on that than in all our other security agencies, domestic agencies combined. And why? Well, what was it dealing with? Well, there was zero net new migration from Mexico last year.
Yeah.
Now we're going to have even more. And scholars find that the militarized, the hardened border actually prevents undocumented workers in the country here from returning to Mexico. So that there's actually a kind of perhaps even a negative effect in the other way from a hard border. And you have to say, well, why did they do this? Well, it's so clear that this is to deal with the anxiety of the Republican right wing that the country is going to be overrun and invaded. And no matter what the net migration statistics say, we have to have that border fixed. And if that's the price, the Republican senators are saying, well, then we'll spend $30 billion or whatever it is, because after all, we have this pot of money going to be saved by immigration reform, and it looks just like a sop to restrictionist anxieties in the U.S.
I mean, how many dollars per apprehended immigrant makes sense? At a certain point, yes, but $1,000, $10,000, $100,000, $1,000,000, I don't know, and a border agent every 1,000 feet? Did you say, Brian? I mean, maybe,
yeah.
But then some are going to be back, buying donuts in town. Trudy, put this in global perspective for us here. Tangle over its border. Are we unique in this? Are we alone in our crazy concern about this border? Or is this the way it works in the world?
Well, first of all, I think you have to say that a lot of this overload is being added to the bill by people who don't want the bill. And so, a lot of it is an effort to kill the bill, because they've seen the statistics that show that in a few decades, the number of white Americans, however you define white, is going to be in a minority.
More deaths than births in that world these days.
Yes, or deaths than births. And so, this is... And in fact, it's also a fear in Europe, being overrun by people of color. Mm. And yes, it is a problem globally. I mean, the problem of refugees, both economic political is drowning many countries. It's even drowning people in the Middle East, where Syrian refugees, already a million of them, are flowing into small neighboring countries, upsetting the political balance. So, this is a global problem driven by economics. And I think, you know, the idea that you can sort of put up a wall like between Israel and the Palestinians, the next thing, you know, you'll have like along the West Bank, along the Green Line, where you have sand patches and constant patrols and different levels of barbed wire. And I don't think you can manage it that way. And ironically, this country is being helped immensely by educated immigrants, which some Republicans recognize. If you go into hospitals in so many sectors of our economy and the sciences, you see that the PhDs are largely immigrants and that there's a great need for skilled immigrants and there's a need for population of immigrants so that we are not like Japan, where the gray heads are dominating the population base.
A great wall of China on the southern border. Border and an open invitation maybe elsewhere. Bruce in Essex, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Bruce. You're on the air.
Tom, regarding the border fence insanity, which is total insanity. I live on 3 acres here in Essex. I spend exactly zero on fences to keep trespassers off my property because trespassing is illegal. People who trust... the only thing that is needed is to first... Presently, trespassing in the United States is merely a misdemeanor. The politicians in Washington refuse to simply make it a felony, and of course, the need for biometric ID cards universally in the country is the only rational solution that's ever been.
You mean when you're going to go out to look for work, you've got to prove that you are who you are and that you're here illegally? I mean, I know what you mean about trespassing, but a felony, that would fill up some federal prisons in a hurry. And you might feel differently, Bruce, if your 3 acres was on the Mexican border and it had, a lot of foot traffic every night.
Tom, if coming into the country illegally meant that you were sent to Alaska to pick up pine cones for a year, very quickly it wouldn't be a problem. The reason we have so many is that it's not enforced. Once something is enforced.
Yeah, but then that's just been impossible to do. And a lot of people, maybe not picking up pine cones in Alaska, but picking strawberries all over the place. We got it, Bruce. One more right here. Jen in Burlington, Vermont. Jen, you're on. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling because my sense is that as more resources go towards the border, it's a way of shifting some of the money that's gone into defense internationally to a domestic use. And I think that public opinion is moving more and more away from intervening internationally, and there's a lot of vested interest in defense in the House and Senate.
Wow, that's interesting. Great wall of China. Bring it home. Build a wall. Stay home. I don't know. Maybe you're right, Jen. I appreciate your call. Trudy, let's take that right to President Obama in Europe. He's talking there about lots of things going on abroad, getting a kind of cool reception from any number of leaders, friend and kind of foe alike, it seemed to me. Syria, the president doesn't want to get involved, and yet we're kind of involved now, saying we're going to bring arms or give arms. He goes to Putin, says, help us, no help.
Yeah, I think this was sort of a sad trip. The president went and spoke at the Berlin Wall 50 years after JFK. And although there was a large crowd there, he's still popular in Germany. There was nothing of the kind of excitement of his earlier trip in 2008, I believe it was. He is going in a weak position. He wants to rely on Russia to help with solving the Syrian problem. He is looking for negotiations as a panacea. But relying on Vladimir Putin, all you had to do was look at the scene of the president sitting next to Putin in Northern Ireland, with Putin sitting there stone-faced and disputing the president and saying, well, of course, they disagreed on Syria. Russia is not going to help the United States on Syria. They want Assad to survive. And then the president went to the Berlin Wall and talked about reducing nuclear weapons. sadly, this is not the major issue of the day. The president wants to go down from 1,500 warheads to 1,000. Putin isn't interested. Congress isn't interested. And yet he made this the centerpiece of his trip. I feel that this trip indicated that Obama's foreign policy is simply off the rails.
I don't know, Brian. Here's a listener. John writes, I hope you discuss Obama's triumphant, quote-unquote, visit to Europe that highlighted how much of a pathetic and irrelevant figure our pretend president has become. Not a supporter here. Much of Berlin, like Putin and Merkel, chose to politely smile when Obama spoke, then moved on to more important things. I mean, Brian, an image of an American president without a whole lot of throw weight, even without the cutbacks and nukes.
You know, I think it's interesting that Berlin speech, the highlight of it was when he took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves and that got the crowd going. It was a small crowd, about 6,000 people. They orchestrated the optics of it. Even, you know, the optics were very weird.
It was hot.
Bulletproof, it was hot, but the bulletproof glass and the smaller crowd compared to the 2008 campaign visit, which was not at the wall, but at the gate. It was kind of down the street with 100,000 folks from Germany.
Catwalk, yep.
And it's interesting, this speech was on the East German side of the wall versus Reagan when he was on the West German side, you know, trying to show those optics. It was kind of orchestrated in a very weird way. And, you know, beyond the nuclear comment, the one comment that actually hasn't been getting a lot of ink that I thought was interesting that he made was when he said that, you know, he hopes for, or wishes for a world, a planet free of AIDS and HIV. And, you know, said maybe not in his lifetime. You know, if he was able to follow through on that, he's got his Africa trip next week, and, you know, comparing his efforts in Africa to what George W. Bush did, you know, that was one of Bush's crowning achievements, was his move on HIV and AIDS. You know, I think Obama has a lot of work to do there.
Jack, what about this American president out in the world, you know, trying to jawbone people, but not really cutting a lot of mustard out there?
Well, it's as if he's a lame duck already to them. You know, the purpose of this trip, at least initially, as I understood it, was all about a big and perhaps even historic free trade agreement with Europe, lowering of tariff barriers, booming of trade and so on. And yet less and less did we hear about that. And I think, and now, of course, there's all sorts of reasons. There are objections in Europe, and they take years to work out. But it was supposed to be a sort of, you know, here is part of my economic agenda. We're going to get the economy, you know, we're going to have freer trade with Europe. And that went by the boards. And so there, it does a feeling about the White House that they're not managing their moments as they should. They didn't. There was the photo op with Putin that really looked it was not a great moment for
Putin. Didn't seem to have the time of day for this man across the table.
No. Yeah, who is this fellow I'm having to deal with here? I want to get out on the do some karate or whatever it is that he does.
Scuba dive.
Yeah, scuba dive, chase birds, but
pocket a few Super Bowl rings.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a feeling that the White House just isn't getting these things as it seemed to, for example, in the campaign. Whenever he was doing, felt golden there.
But this is beyond theatrics, though. Trudy, is this a loss of American power that anybody would be in this situation at this point?
No, it's not just about image, although the image reflects the actual loss of influence because of things on the ground. Look, Obama went out and said for the past 2 years that Assad would go, and yet you had a meeting of the G8. The most important industrial countries in Northern Ireland, which includes Russia. Why Russia should be in that group, I'm not sure. But they all kowtowed to Putin because the United States didn't give any leadership. The Brits and the French want to do more in Syria. Obama does not. His recent announcement of sending small arms to the rebels made him look foolish because it doesn't make any difference. It was clearly a sop. And they omitted any reference to Assad must go from their joint statement because Putin demanded it. That made Obama look insignificant.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the Miami Heat beat the Spurs after all to win their second consecutive NBA championship last night. LeBron James, with and without his headband, was MVP.
Wade throws it up to James. The Spurs will not foul. final seconds. What a finish. It's back-to-back titles for the Heat. The 2013 NBA championship resides once again in Miami.
George Zimmer, founder and public face of Men's Warehouse, fired. We won't be hearing this anymore.
You're going to like the way you look. I guarantee it.
And the inimitable yodeling country singer Slim Whitman has died at 90. We will not forget his Indian love call.
When I'm calling you, will you answer too?
Whoa. Jack, sit down. Take it easy there. I know that guy. I know he's calling you. We're looking at a week in the news. Farm bill in trouble. A Border Patrol surge proposed. The Fed's Wall Street moves and Wall Street reeling. Brazil in the streets wrestling with the Taliban. Trudy Rubin is here from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Brian Monroe, editor of CNNPolitics.com. Let's go to New Orleans and Dallas calling. Hi, Dallas. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling to talk about the president abroad and his, summits and negotiations. I think that America has to get used to a different role in the world now because all of our political capital has been spent, our economic muscle is exhausted, and our military is tapped out and overextended. We just don't bring the same weight to the table abroad anymore, and it doesn't speak to whether our motives abroad are right or wrong, or the president is doing a good job or a bad job. He just does not bring in the same country, the same backing to the table, because the last administration and this country's willingness to go to the war has spent all of that. So we're not in charge anymore, and it's time for us to get used to actually negotiating and not telling people what to do, because we can't anymore.
Dallas, we've got the perspective, and you can kind of feel that that perspective very much in the air. Trudy, do you see it that way? Is that how it really is, or is that just our mood at the moment?
I think there's no question that our capital, political and economic, has been spent down. But I think simply to accept that we have to lean back and let others dictate is both a mistaken perception of our still major role in the world and a mistaken perception of what we can afford to do. I mean, for example, take the Taliban issue. Sit back and accept. The military has long felt that there had to be a negotiated solution. So has the White House. But if you're going to have a negotiated solution, you have to use what leverage you have. We haven't used leverage. These talks with the Taliban are basically a joke. We waited too long. We didn't apply pressure when we had it. And now the Taliban set up virtually an embassy in Doha where they raised a flag and pretended that they were the government of Afghanistan. That flag has been taken down. But if we simply leaned back and accepted what others wanted, Pakistan and the Taliban would take over Afghanistan with awful repercussions in the region and possibly Islamists taking over nuclear-armed Pakistan. So you can't simply sit back and pretend that America no longer has a role in the world. And I think that attitude has pervaded the White House in a sense and has made them not use the leverage that we still have, both economic and military, and not use what we have wisely. Syria is a case in point. There's no time to go into that.
Well, I mean, except that you're saying Syria leaves us in a big strategic hole. Jack, Trudy's making
the
case.
I
read your column, a strategic disaster that undercuts the entire U.S. foreign policy from the Middle East to Asia. If you think she's exaggerating, she writes, read on. And Trudy Rubin writes a lot on that. You can link to it through our website. Jack, Trudy says we should have been more muscular earlier in Syria.
Not with boots on the ground. I don't even think there should have been a no-fly zone. But the both Hillary Clinton and Dave Petraeus and Leon Panetta and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs all thought, and I think rightly so, I've been in Syria, I've interviewed commanders, they all thought that there were vetted secular or moderate Muslim commanders to whom we could have given weapons that would have guaranteed that you didn't have an Assad victory. And if you had a strong vetted opposition coalition militia force, then you could go into negotiations with a chance that Assad and especially Putin would realize that they had to back down. Instead, we did nothing. The Russians know that Assad is winning. It's a disaster for the entire region with sectarian war spreading. And most of all, it shows China, it shows the Taliban, it shows anyone else that wants to roll over us in Asia, in the waters there, in trade, that Obama will back down.
Jack, let me come to you on that. A couple calls right on that front. John in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yes. First, on the Berlin visit, it isn't just in Europe that Obama's popularity has been lost, but in the United States. 70%, 70, now do not want us to arm the Syrian opposition. Hmm. And are we going to arm people who go around eating hearts? Is that what
that is not who the Syrian right? opposition is. That
wait
is
a second,
small, a tiny group.
Wait a second. I only have a few minutes.
You're on, John. You're on. Take it away.
Please. But he was actually a main member of the Free Syrian Army, so-called. But I would
no,
say
he wasn't.
Even worse than that. Ms. Rubin's rhetoric assumes that we have the right and to intervene anywhere in the world. I don't believe that. I'm a founding member of a group called Come Home America. There's right-wingers, left-wingers, Democrats, Republicans. We want nothing more to do with meddling in the affairs of the world. We don't want to pay for it, for one thing, and we don't like to see the loss of human life. And this bellicosity that comes from various quarters, from the military-industrial complex to the Israeli lobby, is doing us damage. Enough, Ms. Rubin, enough.
John, we've got the angle. Trudy, I'll bring that to you, I promise. But Jack, you know, here it is. I mean, it costs a lot to go abroad. Trudy says, look, it can cost a lot not to be effective abroad, and not necessarily militarily, but, you know, you hear in our caller, Come Home America, there is that resistance, and yet the world is out there.
It is out there, but, you know, we were talking about the economic and military constraints on our power. There are also political constraints, and John alludes to them. In a Wall Street Journal poll, I see only 11% of the public wants to arm the rebels. You know, those Americans are reflecting something. They're reflecting our immediate experience with these two wars, neither of which, to most Americans now, seem to have been worth the candle.
Iraq, Afghanistan.
Yes, and so Syria doesn't happen, and Libya, which apparently made very little impression on the public as a good use of American power. And that's the fact. And it's that reality that kept the president. That's why he said no to Hillary Clinton and Petraeus and the others last year. I have an election to win. The public doesn't want this. That's that. Now, perhaps the public needs to wake up and to see the damage to our interests in Syria. But those have not been clear, to me at least, throughout all of this. And then this argument from credibility that Trudy makes, well, yes, there's something to that. But, you know, scholars of international relations looking back say, you'd think that Hitler would have felt that the British and the French weren't credible in August 1939, that they didn't go to war over Czechoslovakia. They won't do it over Poland. No evidence of that. You would think that in the Cuban Missile Crisis, that after the Russians had backed away in Berlin, that the Kennedy administration would say, oh, my gosh, we had them backing away in Berlin. Now we can, they'll back away in Cuba. They did not. Nations defend their interests according to the, you know, whether they're vital and also whether the balance of power favors them. And I don't think anybody in the world really can think the United States is going to back down from a real threat to its security.
Well, Trudy Rubin, are you talking about more war making here or the threat of more war making or something else being required?
No, I'm talking about actively defending our interests. And our interests are not neatly defined by whether we defend against a future war in the Fulda Gap in Germany. If it were that simple, if we could go back to the Cold War bipolarity, then you know what your interests are clearly, and you can stand up tall and defend them. Defending our interests now is far more complicated, and we can't withdraw from the world. At every point, in the United States when this tendency came to the fore, and it lasted a while, and then the world came and bit us, whether it was World War II, whether it was 9-1-1. No, I'm not talking about waging another war in the Middle East, and I was not for going into Iraq with troops. But there are certain seminal issues. I think Syria involves so much more than Syria. It involves Iran. It involves the entire Middle East. It involves Israel. It involves energy. And it involves China. I think you can do certain things at certain moments that show that you will promote your interests. And I think our interests in Syria involve not letting Iran, Hezbollah, Russia, and so forth, basically succeed in promoting a dictator who promotes sectarian war in the region, who uses chemical weapons. And because we haven't done that, I think it sends a message throughout the globe.
Maureen is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Maureen, you're on the air.
Hello. You were talking earlier about Obama looking weak internationally, and I feel like our Congress is doing that to him. You know, the majority of people of the United States voted for him twice, which means we voted for his agenda, and he can get nothing passed in the Senate or Congress, which undermines our democracy and makes us look weak to, our foreign allies and to the world as a whole. He looks like a weak leader because nothing's getting done at home.
We'll pick it up. I appreciate your call, Maureen. Let's get one from Austin, Texas. Geronimo, you're on the air.
Okay, yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I would just have to comment of, the United States getting involved in Syria. I don't think it's a good idea because, that we help Egypt and Libya. I mean, it was a bad decision because what happened in Libya, we got our embassy burned down, the ambassador got killed,
yeah.
But the Marines that got killed also. So I think that it's just impossible to, it's not a win situation for the United States.
Geronimo in Austin, I appreciate your call. Brian Monroe, there you've got Maureen saying, look, it's Congress that's making the president look weak. You've got our caller in Austin, Texas, saying the experience of seeing the consulate burned down in Benghazi, makes him want to come home. What's the source of the problem here, Brian?
Yeah, I think Geronimo in Texas is on to something. You know, look, I am a product of U.S. intervention. I was born in Munich, Germany. My father is a retired two-star general. I know, especially traveling around the world, I've never been to Syria, but traveling around the world, seeing how Americans are being received or not received mm-hmm. on different soil. You know, I think at some point we have to stop and breathe and step back. You've got John McCain out there saying the Middle East is about to erupt. You've got, hands flailing in the air. The Syrian situation is a very delicate one that, Trudy's right. If we went in there with boots on the ground or F-22s in the air, and we would stand a good chance of destabilizing and unseating the regime there. But then what? Then we have Egypt. Then we have Libya. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Then what? I think what's happening in the Mideast is a long-term issue. They're going to have to work through some things, and the U.S. can play a role there. But, whether it is a weakened U.S. and a weakened Obama, look, remember, this is the same president that the world community gave the Nobel Peace Prize to. He had barely enough time to take off his raincoat mm-hmm. before they were calling him the next savior of the world platform. These things come and these things go. We've got to take a longer view.
Hey, Brian, let me ask you, our time grows short, but about the NSA, the new leaks this week, The Guardian out with more from Edward Snowden, this time looking at their guidelines for actually reading what may link to the United States here. We've heard the flat denials that they do that, and yet in these guidelines there are both restrictions and kinds of permissions to read, to snoop, to listen, to watch. Should it be comforting to civil libertarians, Brian, or not what we've learned in these freshest leaks?
Well, I think, again, the bigger picture here is that the argument, the open debate, the robust debate over surveillance policy and everyone's inviting it, It's we did a piece today calling it an empty debate. This is almost already done. It's a done deal.
What do you mean?
The country passed the Patriot Act after 9/11. They reauthorized major portions of it twice. That the rules and the logistics that many would argue Obama's actually strengthened through increased use of the FISA courts and more restrictions. Those are already in place and being used. Now, are they being abused? Are the NSA downloading actual emails and recording conversations without court orders? I think, you know, that's going to remain to be seen. But the argument over is this the right policy? Is this the wrong policy? The country and Congress, remember, this is all three branches of government, the executive, the judiciary with the courts, and the legislative with Congress, have already authorized these moves.
Yeah. I mean,
even if they did it without reading the law.
Fair enough. But, Jack, I mean, the Patriot Act is not the Constitution. These things are open to revision without, you know, two-thirds of the states.
Yes, indeed. And the whole question of how does the FISA court construe that act is at the center of this. The president says it's transparent. That's why we set up the FISA court. The New York Times says, what's he talking about? That court is opaque to the public. It's anything but transparent.
Big week coming up. We'll be watching the Supreme Court and big rulings coming out there. Trudy Rubin, like you, we have an eye on Nelson Mandela. His health has been rough, and he stood for so much in the last couple of decades, Trudy. There's a big tree. Looks like it's in trouble, but what a symbol.
What a symbol. If there were more Mandelas in the world, we wouldn't be having the discussion we had today.
Yeah, we'll be watching Mr. Mandela, wishing him well, but no life is forever. Trudy Rubin with the Philadelphia Inquirer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brian Monroe with CNNPolitics.com. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
And Jack, thanks as always.
Thank you.
HPV vaccine on Monday. We'll look at it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.